for having me today. When I asked Gary what I'm supposed to talk about, he said, talk about you and talk about your success. So I said, really? You know, where do I get started? Am I really that? So I guess, and then Gary gave me some tips to think about. And in terms of being an entrepreneur, for me, it was all I ever wanted to be. You know, I went to school with a lot of people who wanted to be professionals, something or another, lawyers, doctors, engineers, hoteliers, etc. And all I knew was that someday I wanted to own my own business. And I'm the kind of person that has probably an idea a day, an idea folder that I kept my ideas in, and just never realized if one would come to fruition, would discount this idea or that. I think that entrepreneurialism to me is in my blood. I come from a very entrepreneurial family, and there were a lot of examples set in my family for entrepreneurialism. I also think that my family was very supportive of being a woman with a mind and any path in front of her that she could have as equal to that of being a man, or at the time a girl or a boy. So I think that made a big difference on me. And my family also was very strong believers in getting a good education and excelling. And I am the oldest grandchild on both sides of the family. So the bar was set pretty high for me. As Gary mentioned, I went to school in New York. I grew up in New York. And during my senior year of college, I studied to go into advertising. And I always thought I wanted to live and work in Manhattan on, you know, Madison Avenue. And I did an internship in which I lived and worked in Manhattan at an advertising agency my first semester senior year. Hated it. Everything about it. And supposed to go back to college saying, what the heck am I going to do with my life? I'm going to have senioritis. No. I was like left of this quandary. Well, during the course of that internship, it was actually an interesting set up. You go to your workplace 4 days a week and you all convene in a classroom 1 day a week. So there were about 30 of us participating in different internships in different kinds of industries, whatever it was that we had chose. And during this classroom, we had a thesis project in which we were helping the city of New York study its public market system, which was dying. For anybody who is from the New York area, especially in kind of the early 1900s, public markets, much like in Baltimore, everybody knows public markets, Lexington Market, Cross Street Market, Northeast Market, et cetera. They were dying in New York City, and they wanted to preserve them because in certain neighborhoods, that really is the mainstay for where people go to buy things. And in order for us to do this thesis project, we road tripped, and one of the places we came to was Baltimore. Never been to Baltimore before. All I knew of Baltimore was that it was a city in the United States. And I literally, you know, kind of took this tour around the city and said out loud, this city is really charming, never knowing it was Charm City. So go back to Cornell, don't know what I'm going to do, do a few interviews, nothing really pans out, don't want to move back home with mom and dad, because back in those days, that was a no-no. Didn't really think that there was a whole lot of opportunity for me in the lovely bucolic suburb in which I grew up. Didn't want to move to Manhattan, so move was in my future. And I assessed where it was that I felt I would want to go and could afford to go. Back then, you worked in advertising or PR and you started out in the low teens for an annual salary. So you had to be able to afford to live by yourself, especially if it was going to be just me, myself, and I. So I literally picked up and moved to Baltimore, knowing nobody, having no contacts, and just a place to stay, which was kind of like a referral to a referral to a referral to stay with this gal. She's got an apartment. My philosophy back then, and I guess it's one that I adhere to now, is that what's the worst that can happen? I could suck and fail and move back home with mom and dad. So I figured I'd give myself, you know, time to work here. I literally walked into City Hall and spoke to the security guard there who said, I asked him, where does somebody go to find a job in this city? You know, not wanting to go through the classifieds or anything. And the kind guy, swear to God, don't know his name, but he picks up the telephone, calls his boss, who calls his boss or something. They end up sending me over to the fella who I think his name was Neil Spritz, who was the chairman of the GBC at the time. So I have a sit-down meeting with the chairman of the GBC, the Greater Baltimore Committee, and he says, "You're bright, you're young, you're ambitious. I know somebody just like you who actually has a position, not open. She works for the city. I think you should meet with her." So I met with her, and she was the PR director for, at the time it was called BEDCO, the Baltimore Economic Development Corporation. And she did the same thing. You know, you got great talent, you obviously have ambition and moxie. I don't really have an opportunity to hire you for pay, but I'll tell you what, are you willing to intern here? Because I would be willing to have you, and you could put us on your resume. And I was like, I'll be damn sure. So, but still, that wasn't going to pay my bills. And during college, I had also done aerobics instruction. So I went to the local health club, which has changed hands several times, is now a Brick Bodies location in downtown Baltimore, and auditioned among other lots of folks and got a position there. That was a couple days a week, you know, a couple bucks an hour. Really also was not going to pay my rent. And then got a job at Inner Harbor working at a retail store. So I was juggling three jobs. And by the way, that year I moved three times because after 3 months of living with this girl, we never had a lease. And her, it was her brother's best friend's apartment. And he comes home one day and says, "Well, I need the apartment back. My brother's coming home from college. He wants to live here. Bye-bye." And there was nothing we could do. So once again, she goes, "I'm going to go back to Pikesville with my mom. Bye-bye." So I looked in the city paper and found someplace else to live. So you're going to see a pattern here. So after about 4 or 5 months, I actually found a full-time job. My first full-time job in Baltimore was working for the Greater Baltimore Board of Realtors. And that's a trade association for real estate agents. And I was the assistant communications person. And I worked there under the auspices of a wonderful mentor and boss who empowered me to do a lot of things that a young person who's ambitious wants to do, and coached me. And when it was time for her to give birth to her second child, she said, "I am going to stop working and take care of my kids full time." The Board of Realtors approached me about taking on her position. I was not really interested in that job. I took it for a short period of time. But what I had learned in my year and a half at the Board of Realtors was that I didn't like working for trade associations. I'm really a private sector kind of gal. So I go to my health club where I was teacher and became their director of sales and marketing. And I did that, and I caught the eye of somebody who worked at an advertising agency in Baltimore. And I said, "Am I going to get back into this?" But the fact was that I was good at it. And I took a job there. And the whole duration of that job lasted for 4 days. First day, I'm hired by this fella as a junior account executive. That's not bad. First day on the job, the director of human resources takes me around the two-story advertising agency office and introduces me as the new receptionist on the 17th floor. And by day four, when my boss was nowhere to be found and I was not his receptionist, secretary, or anything, and he was not to be found, and this other fellow who wanted him immediately berated me for not knowing where he was and what his whole agenda was, I said, "I'm out of here." So that's strike two for advertising. And then I spent a couple of months and got a year and a half as a nomad. I did some temp work. I was applying for jobs. And I finally found another full-time job. And this is totally out of left field. I was selling food. I worked for Sysco Food Services, which these guys don't buy from because I saw the Continental U.S. Food Service truck outside. But I worked for Sysco Foods. Again, all I knew about food was, damn, I loved it. I love to eat, and I love everything about cooking and eating, and that was my main ability at the time. And the good thing about Sysco is that it has a tremendous sales development program. So I learned how to sell, and it's a very competitive business. It's a very tight margin kind of business. And if you don't have good relationships with your clients and you don't develop core consulting skills, there's nothing that separates you from the next guy who's pounding on the door. Or in my case at Cisco, we were all commissioned only and we were all non-territorial sales reps. So my other fella from my next door in my office could have been knocking on that account at the same time as I was, and until somebody got a signed piece of paper that wasn't any, it was not off limits. So we were competing internally as well as externally. I sold for Cisco for about 4 years, and I became a multi-million dollar salesperson, and I got the benefit of going through both regional and national training at Cisco. And I would say that that was the biggest takeaway that I got was my grandfather, who is no longer alive but was alive back then, who is one of the key influences in my life, gave me another sage piece of advice at the time. And that piece of advice was learn on someone else's dime. So I was a sponge and I was soaking up everything that I could learn about sales. But I got tired of it. And I didn't tire of the company, and I was approached because people had known that they had either known about my background beforehand in sales and marketing, or they had just seen what I was doing for my own customers because I was really a marketing consultant for my customers. And they asked me if I would take over the marketing position. The fellow who was occupying it was being promoted down to national. So I came in-house. And when you come in-house in a sales organization, you go from being, you know, the big cheese to just another support person. So even though I was in charge of all the marketing for this organization, and I did so for 2.5 years and managed a budget in excess of $5 million, I was still a peon. That's okay. That wasn't the part that bothered me. The part that bothered me is, I told you earlier, I was raised in an environment where I was told that women can do anything and that women have an equal playing field. And this is not a female-friendly kind of organization, at least at the time. I don't know what it is nowadays. And whereas the person whose position I had taken over was a director of marketing, after 2.5 years in the position, and I was told after 1 year that I would be considered for that position, I asked what the heck is going on with my career here. And they said, oh, we've eliminated that title from the org chart. So I said, so, you know, what are the opportunities for me? Well, you can move to another Cisco house, which meant literally picking up and moving. Or you could take a job in national. Again, that's in Houston, Texas. Or you could be marketing manager for the rest of your duration here. That was not the right answer for me. So, And one other thing of note, in my time at Cisco, especially in the sales sector, there were many younger women than I who were smart and bright and came in and started up their career and along the way had children and were leaving because they were making this decision between working and mothering. And I thought to myself, wow, I would really like to tap into those kinds of women, that talent. There's got to be something that they can do at home. So that was just a little nugget I had in my head. In about January, February 1998, I was leafing through a magazine, and I was struck with what was essentially an epiphany. I had seen an ad in that magazine, a small ad, that was featuring some advertisers in that magazine, primarily just to give the web address. It was 1998. Okay, not much was happening in terms of web marketing at the time. And I thought, that's a phenomenal concept because, you know, Google didn't exist. Finding stuff was relatively hard, and you had to know about it. And I realized at that moment in time that web entities were businesses just like terrestrial entities were, brick and mortars were, and they're going to need marketing too. So I devised this to copy this, to replicate this idea, but instead of to have it in, like, for the advertisers of that same magazine, I would collect the advertisers and carve up ad space, resell the ad space at a fraction of what it would cost to buy that ad space if you bought it solo, and that way you could get your web address out there and people could find you. So that was my business model. Quit my job, incorporated. Got a letter about a month later from the SBDC here in Harford County saying, We offer free business consulting. No strings attached. No, it's not too good to be true. I was like, you got to be kidding me. Okay, I'll respond. And I went in to see that fellow. He's still there. He's the executive director, Russ Teeter. And at the time, he was just getting started, and he had no clients. And so it was a perfect time for me to be his client. And he sat down with me and said, do you have a business plan? No. Do you have goals? No. I mean, I said, this is really hard because I'm setting precedent. There really isn't anything like this out there. So what am I supposed to build it on? What am I supposed to forecast based on? So that was my biggest challenge. And he helped me kind of model some things out in a way that was okay with me. I didn't have to like be drawing lines in the sand about things that I had no idea. And there wasn't any reference material that you could look that up. So I was working with the graphic designer who I'd worked with at Cisco when I was the marketing manager, and we mocked up an ad, and I'm then cold calling, and it's posted on my, I have a website, it's posted on my website, and I'm cold calling and trying to drum up business, and people were sort of lukewarm to my idea. They're like, you know, that's interesting, but can you buy me advertising banners? No. Can you site link for me? No. Can you do email help for me? No. Something to all this. And that's when I realized, epiphany number two. If the market demand is not here, I'm going to go where the market demand is. So dropped that whole business model, went online, because back then there really wasn't any way to learn this stuff. There's a couple of books that are antiquated as soon as they're published. And the thing to do was to join listservs and discussion groups and read forums, and I actually took an online course back then in 1998 and learned how to do this and network through your peers who were all over the world literally back then. And after about 3 months, somebody contacted me and said, can you do for me what you're doing for yourself? And that's when I knew I was ready. That's when I knew I was ready to sell what it was that I was doing. So rebranded Web Advantage as an online marketing service provider. And there I was. So that's how I kind of got started. Of course, good e-marketing best practices, especially at that time, where you want to have an email newsletter and you want to write about substantive content. You don't want it to just be fluff because nobody's going to want to read it. Well, I started a newsletter. I started writing about essentially what I was learning, kind of just translating. And somebody who was reading my content asked me if they could republish it. And they republished it on a website called eMarketer. And the very funny thing is eMarketer is still around. If you look at it, it's now a sort of a statistical clearinghouse. They do some of their own data analysis and they resell reports of other people, etc. But back then it wasn't that kind of thing. It was information for online marketers. So they started republishing my content. And then a fellow reader of the eMarketer newsletter read my content, and he contacted me and said, I would like for you to be a columnist for us. And this was ZDNet, which is Ziff Davis Publications, and that was a big deal. So I took that position, which was not paid. It was just for the visibility, and I think my commitment was like an every other week article. And, you know, it's very funny because I think back to those days when I had all the time in the world to be doing this stuff. And I don't have all the time in the world I'm a biweekly columnist now, and I don't even have that time, but somehow I find the time to do that. So that kind of gave me leverage and started positioning me as an expert. And through that appearance of expertise, and, you know, I suffered in the beginning from imposter syndrome. Do you know what that is? So I had a really hard time thinking of myself as an expert because I had no idea what I was doing. And I swear, for the first 5 years of business, I had no idea what I was doing. I would joke about because I don't think that it was as accepted. Certainly online marketing wasn't as accepted as it is now. And there's always going to be somebody who's better at it than you are, who knows more than you do, or who has more multifaceted talents than you do. So that was a really tough marquee to absorb. But it did open doors for me. And then locally, Comcast started republishing some stuff that I wrote. which led to a consulting project, which led to a client, which led to a bigger contract. And before you know it, I was kind of really rolling in the throw of everything. Now, kind of prior to all that, I realized that now that I had changed the business model to a service business, I was not possibly going to be able to do everything, sell, service, write, you know, maintain, all of the things that need to go into a service business. So I first put an internship position posted in the Towson University Board Career Center, and I got a response from a fella who came to work for me as an intern a couple days a week while he was at school. And the really great thing is he was a great mind. He was a very creative mind, very good thinker, definitely green when it came to processes and how to work and how to manage expectations and time management. But I could handle that part. I think I could craft him that way. But in terms of replicating what he had upstairs, I was very lucky. In the meantime, he was not like on a payroll or anything. He was a unpaid intern. In the meantime, he was only working for me a couple days a week, and I was starting to get this other business on realizing. And there's nobody for hire, mind you, back in 1998, 99, doing this stuff. You know, you were either self-taught or you were doing something else. And I came back to that idea that I had of these smart females leaving the workforce and staying at home. And I realized that I have this business model now that's perfect to support trying to recruit stay-at-home moms who still wanted to work and activate their brain and do something. So, again, I went on the web and I posted on all sorts of mommy boards and forums. I'm a female entrepreneur with a brand new business. It's online marketing. I am willing to train you, but the deal will be that I will train you for free, and you'll get everything that I know, but you have to, during your training time, you have to work for free, essentially. You have to develop your aptitude. And so when you're at a level where I can feel comfortable giving you work, then I'll pay you. And I actually got more responses to that than I could handle, because I was going to be doing the training, and it was all going to be remotely for these people. But I whittled down the list, and there were a couple, and I developed training modules and everything, and there were a couple people who kind of stuck it out till the end, and I had this core workforce of three moms who were all over the country. One was in North Carolina, another was in Pittsburgh, another one was in Utah, and then over the years I kind of added and subtracted, and these became my mommies. So to this day, one of my mommies still works for us, and the funny thing is, at the time, her family and friends told her, "What are you doing? Why are you believing this crazy lady? There's freaks all over the internet, you know? Don't trust her." And she said that there was just something about what my appeal had said that clicked with her, and she did trust me. And she's the one who's laughing now, because she probably makes just as much money as her husband does, and she is able to juggle her family and her life and her work. So she's very loyal and devoted, and she knows how old Web Advantage is because it's how old her daughter is. Her daughter was born the same year. So that's kind of like the fundamentals of how Web Advantage came to be. And, you know, having started in 1998, watched as a lot of companies rose in 99 and 2000 and flourished, and we were still small and still boutique and frustrated, because there were a lot of kind of crazy business plans being launched and funded, and agencies popping up all over the place, taking in huge amounts of dollars and having big blowout parties, and, you know, and I'm watching it going, they're actually not delivering any service. Everybody's just playing ping pong all day long and, you know, buying advertising like who cares, because it doesn't really work. Whereas what we were was much more ROI driven, again, very strategic. What is your objective? Let's figure out what's appropriate for your objective, et cetera. And we wanted to make that work. So it was very frustrating back in those days, because we knew we were doing a lot better work than some of the big shops. Well, just desserts may be that a lot of those shops folded after the dot-com bust. And their survivors may have, you know, found jobs elsewhere and still doing well. But we hung in there. It wasn't easy, you know, dot-com bust days were really tough, post-dot-com bust days were really tough. Had to lay off a few people, but also tried to work with my staff. Some people I didn't want to have to totally lay them off, so I kept them on part-time, did whatever I could, and tried to make it work. And then probably late 2003, early 2004 is when the market started turning around, and light bulbs were going off over everybody else's head about the power of the web and how the web had penetrated not just, you know, your own personal use, but the business, everyday use. And that's when things really started picking up for us. And we've been, you know, kind of on this peak inclination ever since. So it's good kind of validation of sticking it out and making it work. So along the way, I definitely feel like I've developed some words of wisdom for other entrepreneurs. Sometimes I get asked these questions. So my business advice. Well, the first one I would say is, and I'm going to give you a summary list with my really core ones, but I think that if you are in the kind of industry in which a figurehead would be helpful, become an expert or try to position yourself as a leader in your field, because you will get recognition, you will be associated with your business. Do mentoring, which also gives you visibility. Anything to kind of make, to differentiate your company and yourself from everybody else in your field, because it's very rare that any of us are in something so unique that we have no competition. So that's one thing. I'm a really strong believer in defining your business philosophy and sticking to it and not compromising your integrity. You know, I now have a staff of 14, and I started out myself in my house. And I think it's really important that you have that focus and philosophy, because as you evolve, you know, I'm not a 50,000 company kind of place, and I don't think I want to get to that point. But knowing who you are and being able to imbibe that in what you do and communicate that to who you hire is really important. They're going to know where you stand. For example, in my company, it's really important that we make a strong effort to show the quality of our work. It's not about cutting corners, doing junk. You know, it's really important that everybody knows that my expectation is that the client is getting very good caliber work. And if I see spelling errors or typos or wrong names or whatever in an email deliverable or in a product deliverable, they're going to hear it from me. So, and that there are, in some of the work that we do, for example, we do search engine optimization, which helps you get higher rankings in search engines. There are ways to do that that kind of are called black hat techniques. Those are not acceptable in our agency, and nor should they be acceptable anywhere, because ultimately if Google or the other search engines catch on, they could potentially blacklist your website and then it'll be banned from the search engine altogether. And let me just tell you, search engines are really important in your business marketing strategy. But so knowing what that business philosophy is and what your integrity is and being able to communicate that is really important. I feel that you need to pay for top-notch professional talent. And the best thing I ever did was, for my very first big contract, I hired a big Baltimore law firm. And I paid a lot of money for it. And one of the reasons I did that was because I knew my client had a big Baltimore law firm. And when I went to go to contract negotiation with them, I think they expected to step on my face. And I came back to them with, you know, like a draft proposal that was from the law firm, and they said, what law firm are you dealing with? And I gave them the name, and I know that when they took that back to their law firm, who I knew who that was, that they would say, oh, guess we're serious here. But I knew that they wanted to hire me too. So, and I believe that all the time. So whether it's my accounting firm is, you know, BBJ top 20, you know, it's just, that's not to say that you want to leap both feet first, but do your homework, do some good vetting, and hire good professional talent, because it's going to give you confidence, and it's also going to make sure that you're doing the best that you can do for your business. It's like protecting your business assets. Gary said, is there anything that you would do differently? You know, let's see. You know, I really have no regrets in terms of what I've done. And that's not to say that there aren't times that are difficult or I go, why am I doing this? But the one thing that I would say that I'm still trying to learn how to do differently is to not vest myself so personally in my business and my staff. I treat my staff like they're my family, and sometimes they don't treat me back that same way, and that's hard for me. So that's the one thing that I would say I'm still trying to evolve out of, although sometimes people tell me that's what makes you, Hollis. So that's not something that you necessarily want to change. I don't know. When it hurts, I do. What challenges will businesses face in the future? I think that we're going to have a fairly large challenge from the millennial generation, the me generation, who doesn't really believe in sticking around a job more than 6 months, 6 to 12 months. They were not imbued with good work ethics for the most part. I know I'm generalizing here, but I've lived through this. They just want to climb on board of what's hot, what's cool, and get their kicks, and if it's not for them, they move on. Or they expect you to treat them the way the parents did, which was a lot of coddling and a lot of spoiling and hand-holding, and I'm not like that. I mean, you come to work, my philosophy at work is it's 9 to 5 at WebAdvantage. It's really rare that people stay later because I want you to have a life outside of WebAdvantage. It's really important that you have a work-life balance. And if you're at WebAdvantage, you're working 129% or more than that. You know, it's totally okay for you to be leaving at 5. There's no corporate culture like where you can't leave at 5, and I worked in a lot of places like that. But when you're here, you're on your game. And I don't really find that generation comes with their game on. It's fun and games for them. So I think that's going to be a problem. It's a malaise on our economy, and for that matter, I think that we're also going to see global pressures on our economy because there are other nations, developing nations, that their young people take this very seriously, and they want to be a superpower economically, and we don't seem to want to. And it's a lot easier in this day and age to do business globally than ever before because of the internet. And so if people don't take things seriously in this country at large, I think we're probably not going to be an economic superpower in the next, you know, 30 years. Where do I find encouragement? Well, number one, I try to find encouragement in all the little things in life. I was so anxious to grow up when I was a kid that I did not do a good job of stopping and smelling the roses. So I try to stop and smell the roses more these days. My office is in downtown Havre de Grace, and if you've ever come down Route 155 on the hilltop and you can see the sun on the water in the morning, it's just the best thing ever. It's like why I love working there, and I drive 45 minutes to my office when I go to work because I live in Delaware now. But on a daily basis, I would say my number one cheerleader is my husband. He is just phenomenal. You know, he's been my rock and my support all the way through. I just got another award. I'm a winner of the 2008 Enterprising Women of the Year by Enterprising Women magazine, and I forwarded that to him because it's not public yet, so don't go talking about it. And he said, you know, I'm going to make a whole list of all these things that you've accomplished, which is why when you read off, you know, it's very funny to me, because sometimes you don't remember yourself. So he's fantastic that way. And my grandparents, my grandfather, who's not alive, and my grandmother is 93, always believed in me, always. And there's, you know, my grandmother is so proud, and she says, you know, I'm telling Grandpa what you're doing. So, and I know it, you know, like sometimes I hear these little voices in my head. Because another thing Grandpa taught me was, you know, I'm in a field where creativity matters, where what our ideas are, what our concepts are, is our IP, you know, intellectual property. And he said, you keep giving all of that away for free. You know, you meet with somebody and you start riffing because you've got all these ideas. You're giving them away for free. Don't keep doing that. I said, I have to, Gramps. How else are they going to know that I have anything to offer? He said, well, tease them with a couple of ideas. Don't just give it all away for free. But I also have great friends, great colleagues, peers. I really just try to, although I'm a cynical person by nature, I try to look on the positive side of things. So, in conclusion, I want to share with you what I think are my five important tenets. The first is to marginalize risk. Think of it as taking chances, not taking risk. Maybe that'll help ease your mind, and don't do the whole analysis by paralysis thing. The second is to learn to trust your gut. That has been seriously one of my strongest development as an entrepreneur since I started. I was doing internet marketing in 1998, people. People were like, do you build websites? No, that's not what my company does. Well, then what do you do? I help companies market themselves through the internet. What is that? Do you know how many times I got questioned and I could have gone, am I doing the right thing? But my gut told me that I was doing the right thing, and I stuck with it, and my gut tells me a lot now, and I have really learned to trust it. So I say trust your gut. The third is to be open to help from unexpected places, and if you need help, go out and seek it. I think entrepreneurs sometimes we're too focused and kind of uptight that we need to know how to do this. We're afraid to ask for help, and it's really important to be able to ask for help. But also, kind of once you open yourself up to the idea that I need help solving this problem, sometimes it just shows up on your doorstep, kind of a surprise. And then this one I learned from Cisco, but I have modified it. In Cisco, it was ask for the order. And I probably don't even do as good of a job at that as I could. But in my philosophy is don't ask, don't get. So I have, in one way or another, asked for a whole lot of things that were not offered, not necessarily expected. But if you don't ask that question, you're never going to get it. So better to get the no answer than not ask the question. And then the fifth is to lead by example and to not just be a good leader, be a great leader. And that's my daily challenge, is I'm running an organization that's growing, and more my duties are management of people and projects and, stuff, bigger picture stuff. But I am that captain of the ship, and it's really important for me, for everybody to know that that we're a great organization and that hopefully they think of me as a great leader. And that's something I constantly work on. So that's it. Thank you so much. Thank you.